I wanted to thank Pastor Brett for asking me to come and speak to you this morning. I want to thank all of you for listening, although I don't know how much choice you had in the matter. So, I wanted to talk to him this morning about something that is really important to me. It's been important, especially over the last few weeks and months, but as long as I've been doing ministry, it's something that I've been focused on. Because it seems that even though we as people of faith and we as Christians, we know certain things about our faith, but as Ross prayed today for transformation, I think that's the key. The transformation often seems to elude us, doesn't it? How many of you have ever been depressed? Yeah, see, for me, I think it was pretty much all of the 80s. And
you're assuming it's past tense.
Well, that's the next question. How many of you are depressed right now? That can be rhetorical. You don't need to put your hand up. Thank you, Grendel, for being so brave. And how many of you plan to be depressed in the future? All right. You know, is it all right for Christians to be depressed? Is it all right? Sort of a trick question, I suppose. But, you know, we Christians tend to shoot our wounded a lot of the times, it seems like. There is an inevitability to the cycle of our feelings, our emotions, and our psychological states and all of that. We cycle through things. Things happen to us. There's a series of little deaths that occur in our lives that we have no control over. Sometimes they're real deaths. They're major deaths. If we don't go through some sort of cycle, some sort of trough in our lives, then we're not fully human. We're not fully connected to things. On the other hand, if those cycles, if those troughs, if those low points in our lives get calcified, get sort of permanentized into a state of depression and despair, well, then there's something wrong as well. The grief that you go through, whether you've lost a loved one or whether you've lost a job or whether you've lost a dream, any of these things are little deaths and they go through the same cycle of grief in our human emotions. That's as it should be. God designed us that way. That's what's supposed to happen. But we're supposed to cycle and come back out the other side. Now, we as people of faith, there are tools that we have, that we hope we have, that others may not, to be able to shallow out those cycles, to squash them this way so they're not as long, and to allow more space in between them. But it doesn't always seem to be working that way, and that's what I wanted to talk to you about this morning. Sometimes as Christians, we want to have the pat answer. Have you ever had someone ask for a definition of a word, and everybody jumps in because they all want to give that definition? It's like when someone has a problem, we all want to jump in, we want to give that answer, we want to help. But sometimes the things aren't so helpful. One of the things that I've heard, this comes under the category of shooting our wounded, to be depressed is to be focused on yourself and not on God. So how depressing a view is that, of course, if you're focused on yourself and not on God? Now, I suppose that's a true enough statement, but how helpful is it? Another one that I've heard, to be depressed is an insult to God. It's like, oh great, now I have guilt. And my all-time favorite, just snap out of it. Now, if anyone says that to you, you do have my permission to punch them dead in the face. If you could, you would, right? Being depressed is kind of like being in a dark room. There's a light switch there someplace. Maybe you know there's a light switch. Maybe you don't even know there's a light switch. But regardless, you don't know where it is. To say to snap out of it, to say to just turn on the light and come out of the dark, it's just a non sequitur. It just has no meaning to someone who's in the midst of it. Sometimes being depressed is like being in a black hole. It's where our emotions come and close over on ourselves. We can't see any way out. Sometimes people have had such traumatic childhoods and upbringings and traumas in their past, they don't know any other way of life. I was talking to a guy whose life was completely unmanageable, was falling apart, and I'm talking to him about it. He says, well, what's so bad? He couldn't even see that there was another there somewhere that he could go to. It just didn't compute. This is all he'd known. To say snap out of it is just not helpful. You know, you think of Job, the classic in scriptures, going through all these troubles, and everyone who tries to help him, quote unquote, his wife, just curse God and be done with it, okay? And each of his friends coming through, you must have done something to deserve this. And then another classic, it's just a lack of faith. You got to have more faith, brother. Got to have more faith. Well, how do you get more faith? You know, we can say it's all about salvation into the next life, but Jesus said, I came to bring you life and bring it abundantly. And he meant that in the context of what he was saying here and now. I like to say that heaven is waiting for us, but we don't have to wait for heaven. Think about that for a second. We don't. Jesus said the kingdom is here. He said it's not going to be by looking or observation. It's going to be within you. It's among you. It's in your midst. It's all these things. Jesus is telling us there is a transformation that can happen now. There is something that can happen now. We have a men's group every week, and one of the guys was being really open and transparent, sharing that he was going through a terrible time. And he was feeling unworthy. He was feeling like he isn't pleasing to God. He's feeling like he'd failed in many places in his life. And he was just kind of pouring himself out. And everybody jumped in and wanted to help, as it happens. All the Bible verses came out and all these things came out. And I just sat back and I was thinking, you know what? It's not a rational argument. It's not a line that you can draw from A to B to take him from this place that he's in to the place that he thinks he wants to be, he imagines he wants to be. What's going on here? Imagine falling into a well, a deep well. You want to get out. And so everybody is throwing lines down to you, because that's one way to get someone out of a well, right? Throw down a rope and let them climb out. The problem is, what you think is a rope, they may not see as a rope at all. It's dark down there, right? They may not be able to see what it is you're throwing to them. What they can see, what they can touch, may not seem like anything that's life-saving at all. All of our attempts to do that, to bring them out, is not what is needed. And it's not the way Jesus taught either. And that's a key. We're going to explore that in a second. Jesus didn't teach that way. He didn't throw down lines. He used a different method. And we have to use that method too. Depression is a frustration of what we think we should be doing or what we think we should be having. Or it's a frustration of who we think we are. Right? If it comes right down to it, think of it this way. We all live in the space between our expectations and our circumstances. Let me say that again. We all live in the space that we create between the expectations we have of what we think is true and the actual circumstances of what is true. That's where we live, in that space. Now, the wider those two points are apart, the more miserable we are. Why? Because our expectations are not being met. The closer those two points are together, the happier we feel. Until, you know, we have those days where our expectations and our circumstances are the same. That's a good day. Bottle it. Sell it. And then, maybe I should just whisper this, sometimes our circumstances actually exceed our expectations. Ooh. There's a great line from a movie called Broadcast News. One character says, "What do you do when your life exceeds your expectations?" The other character says, "Keep it to yourself." If you haven't seen that movie, it's a great study of two characters. One who doesn't expect much out of life and just seems to get everything handed to him. And the other one who expects so much and is continually frustrated. But we live in that space. I can tell you, you cannot overestimate the importance of expectations in your life and what they do in your life. They are central. They're everything. The expectations that you have are actually the rules that you've created by which you play the game of life. They're your rule book. They're the, if you want to call it a worldview, if you want to call it an assumption, call it whatever you want, but it's actually the floor on which you walk. It's what you've created as the model for your world. This is the way the world works according to you, your expectations. It can also form the walls of your cage if it gets too calcified in there. Think of it as a window if you want to. It's the window through which you look at life. If your expectations are grounded in and match reality as it is, then the window's clear and you see things in an undistorted way. But if it's colored, if it's warped, if it's this, you get the idea. The expectations form everything. They're central. Even our senses of humor are based on expectations. You ever thought of that? You know, what does a joke do? It takes you down one road where you're expecting a certain thing, and then the punchline kicks in and takes you someplace completely different, right? Henny Youngman, take my wife, please. Okay? It's taking you down one road and then drops you someplace else. One of my love from Groucho Marx. My boy, I think you've got something there, and I'll wait outside until you clean it up. Expectations. Takes you somewhere and drops you someplace else. Another movie, City Slickers. Oh, great, we're lost, but we're making great time. All of these set you up in one way. You're expecting something, and it takes you someplace else. We were watching Monty Python and the Holy Grail the other night. Talk about the whole thing is when, you know, you got this big, majestic music, you know, lots of French horns and low brass coming up, and you've got the hill with the mist and all this, and you hear the horse galloping, and you expect to see, you know, mighty King Arthur coming through the horse, and you have this guy, you know, kind of skipping like this, and a guy behind him with coconuts making the horse sounds. That's unmet expectations in a good way. We don't expect. Why do we love to laugh? We love to laugh because when our expectations are broken that way, it's like taking a vacation from ourselves. For that moment when we throw back our heads and laugh, we're not thinking about anything else. It's just so good to realize that the emperor has no clothes sometimes. You know? It's not so serious. It's not what I expected. It's not so heavy. It's not this. That's why laughter is wonderful. Think about optimism and pessimism. The glass is half empty or the glass is half full. It's the same reality out there. What are your expectations? What's the frame of reference by which you work it? There's a couple of quotes that I just think are wonderful from Michael Levine. A pessimist is someone who complains about the noise when opportunity knocks. James Cabell said, optimists proclaim that we live in the best of all possible worlds. Pessimists fear that this is true. And then again, my favorite Groucho, he says, a child of five would understand this. Send someone to go fetch a child of five. It's so simple, but we miss it, isn't it? It's all in the way that we look at life. How do you look at life? What are your expectations? Think about it. What were your expectations of your life when you were 20? Some of you still are, or less than that. What did you expect out of life? What were you thinking about? Where were you going? Then at 30, how did it change? 40? 50? Do you think your expectations are going to change in the next 5 or 10 years? And how did that affect the choices that you made? Every choice you made was based on the expectations you had. Were you getting a fair deal? Were things arrayed against you? Now, what did you think about, what were your expectations about marriage before you entered it? And what was it like after you got in? What were your expectations about parenthood? Nothing will change your life like a child, right? Those of you who know that, who had one. But what were your expectations about what child rearing was going to be like? What were your expectations of church? Outside, inside, a job, prayer. What do you expect out of prayer? What do you expect out of God? Is God supposed to take every bad situation in your life and fix it? If you expect that, you're going to have a reality that's going to make it difficult for you to just get through the day. Because God often doesn't work like that. Our expectations are everything. So, is there any basis for this in Scripture, however? I think yes. Let's take a look at Matthew 11. If you have your Bibles, go ahead and go to Matthew 11, verse 2. I want to read you two quick stories about two characters in the Bible who exhibit expectations, and the expectations are not met, and exactly what goes on with them, and exactly what Jesus does in trying to inform them about the situation. The first one is about John. The second one is about Simon. John is John the Baptist. Now, at this time, John is in prison. He's in prison because he is exactly who he is all the time. The king had dumped one wife and married another, and John stood up and said, that is not right, and he got in prison for his trouble. He's awaiting execution. He's rotting away in jail, and he hears all these things about Jesus and his ministry. But it's not as straightforward as he thought, because he says, And when John had heard in prison about the works of Christ, he sent two of his disciples and said to him, "Are you the coming one, or do we look for another?" Now, your translation might, are you the one that we should expect, or should we look for another? Jesus answered and said to them, "Go and tell John the things which you hear and see. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. And blessed is he who is not offended because of me." What is going on here? Let's recall here. John is the guy of whom it was prophesied by an angel before he was born that he would come in the spirit and the power of Elijah, that he would be the breaker who would go before the way of the Lord. He's the one who leapt in his mother's womb when she was pregnant with him, when Mary approached pregnant with Jesus. He's the one at the River Jordan who's seen Jesus coming far off, said, "I shouldn't be baptizing you, you should be baptizing me." He's the one who later said, "His sandals I'm not even worthy to untie." He's the one who said, "I must decrease and he must increase." And now he's the one who's saying, "Are you the one we were expecting, or should we look for another?" What happened to John? You know, this is a passage that often has been kind of whitewashed, and we don't talk about it too much. And the Bible's a wonderful book because it's a master of understatement, isn't it? You really have to read between the lines. I was a lit major in college, and so I'd spent whole semesters on people like Ernest Hemingway and William Faulkner and Shakespeare and so on and so forth. And Hemingway is the master of the short sentence, if you've read any Hemingway. I remember one sentence he started a story off with was, "It was hot." That was it. He has a short story called The Clean, Well-Lighted Place that is only a page and a half long. It's one of the shortest short stories in American literature. Now, William Faulkner, on the other hand, had one sentence that was a page and a half long. So different types of writers. But the Bible is like Hemingway in a certain sense. It is so short, so spare. But read between the lines. What is going on in John's life here that would cause him to ask Jesus? Some commentators have speculated that John never lost his faith. John never doubted. What he was actually doing was for the benefit of his disciples. They hadn't had the opportunity to know who Jesus was, so he sent them asking this question so it could be proven by Jesus to them. I don't know, it seems like a bit of a reach to me, but it's possible, I suppose. Another one is that John has been in prison for some time now. He's only hearing about Jesus second hand or third hand. Maybe he's wondering if this is the same guy that he baptized in the River Jordan. Okay, that's possible. Another one says, well, maybe because John so expected that he was going to be at Jesus' side through all of his ministry and what he was doing, and here he is rotting in prison and facing execution, that the two things just didn't jive, and so he's not sure anymore. I think that's getting closer to the truth, but I think it's even deeper than that. Every detail that we know about John's life in the gospel identifies him, as an apocalypticist. Have you ever heard of the Essenes? They were a separatist group, kind of like the ones that, think of the Amish, or think of those who go into the hills of Montana and Idaho. These were the ones who were the purists, the ultra-conservatives, and they were so disgusted by what they saw happening in Israel that they moved out into the desert and they formed their own communities. Their imagery that we found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the words they used, the things that they expected, all jive very well with what we have for John in the Bible. John was focused on full repentance. He was focused on turning around and coming back to the Lord, a full immersion baptism, all these things classify him as one of the Essenes, if not an actual Essene, at least someone who thought the way they did. The apocalypticists that believed that the Messiah was going to come back in true power, you know, in the spirit and the glory of God, and he was going to change Israel from top to bottom and reestablish the throne of David, oust the Romans, and put Israel back where it was supposed to be. If John believed that when he baptized Jesus, and then he starts hearing about Jesus' actual ministry, what kind of cognitive dissonance was that? Here is Jesus not coming as an ascetic, not coming who was someone who was fasting and eating locusts and honey in the desert, but someone who is drinking wine and having feasts with sinners, prostitutes, tax collectors, and someone who is alienating the power base of the religious authorities, with whom he was going to have to work, supposedly, I suppose, as the temporal Messiah who was going to change everything. What John was expecting was someone like him, or at least someone like the idealized idea of who the Messiah was going to be in his image. And Jesus didn't come that way. Jesus threw off the reins of power wherever he could. Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world." Jesus said, "My kingdom is really in your heart. And where it's going to be realized is from the inside to the outside, not from the outside to the inside, from the bottom to the top and not from the top to the bottom." And so John says, "Are you really the one? Or should we expect somebody else?" But notice what Jesus does. Does he throw him a line down into that deep hole where John is and say, "Oh, yeah, let me send you this memo on Tripica, and here's how it works, buddy, and just have faith"? No. He basically tells John again what he already knows. The blind see, the lame walk, the dead are raised. And he's basically echoing the scriptures from Isaiah anyway that Jesus quoted when he first started his ministry in Nazareth. Jesus has a different way of getting us out of that well. And instead of throwing us a line to pull us out, he takes a shovel full of dirt and throws it down the well. Now, what do you think that feels like? You're down there crying out to the Lord and you get a shovel full of dirt on your head. "What are you doing, Lord? What is this all about?" But then another one comes, and another one comes. You know, after about 4 or 5 feet have built up on the bottom of the well, you start to get the idea of what the Lord is doing. He's layering up images and ideas and concepts that will raise you up slowly instead of a line to pull you out. If you just pull someone out of a well, what have they really learned about wells? Not only that, that hole is still there in the ground. When the Lord is finished with you, you'll know all about that particular hole. And that hole will be filled, and you won't have to fall into that sucker again. It's a whole different process, isn't it? It's a layering up of images. Think of the way Jesus teaches. He almost never answers a direct question with a direct answer. He asks another question, doesn't he? Or he tells a story. And in this case, he tells John what he already knows, but he's reminding him, maybe saying in a sense, "Return to your first love, John. Remember what it was like at the beginning? I know things are tough now, but do you remember?" Let's read a second story, see if we can solidify this. Go to Luke 7, verse 36. Jesus is invited to a feast by a Pharisee named Simon. And in Luke's version, we don't get that right away, but in the parallel verses, we know that this is Simon. He's often translated Simon the leper, but he could be Simon the jar merchant or Simon the potter. We don't exactly know. There's some dissonance in the Aramaic there. But at any rate, in verse 36, then one of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him. And he went to the Pharisee's house and sat down to eat. And behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus was at table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil and stood at his feet behind him weeping. And she began to wash his feet with her tears and wipe them with the hair of her head. And she kissed his feet and anointed them with the fragrant oil. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he spoke to himself saying, "This man, if he were a prophet, he would know who and what manner of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner." And Jesus answered and said to him, "Simon, I have something to say to you." And he said, "Teacher, say it." "There was a certain creditor who had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. And when they had nothing with which to repay, he freely forgave them both. Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him more?" Simon answered and said, "I suppose the one to whom he forgave more." And he said to him, "You have rightly judged." Simon's logic is impeccable, isn't it? If he were a prophet, he would know who and what manner of woman was touching him. Now, in the Peshitta, in the Syriac, it says he would know her fame. So this is a woman who was known throughout this town as a sinner. Now, if she had the money for an alabaster jar, she was probably a prostitute. because there wasn't a lot of ways for women to make a whole bunch of money in those days. But at any rate, whatever she was doing, it was well known and telegraphed throughout. Simon knew who she was. If this man were a prophet, he would not allow this woman to touch her because he'd know who she is. What is he presupposing? He's presupposing that Jesus approaches sinners the way he does. As a Pharisee, one of the things that the Pharisees did absolutely was to shun those who were what they called the Am HaAretz, the people of the land, the people who were not of Torah. In fact, they would walk on the inside of the street so that the clothing of the great unwashed wouldn't even brush their clothing because that would make them unclean. They would no more sit at a table with a sinner than eat pork. And here is Jesus allowing this woman to do all these things to his feet. But what he didn't get was that Jesus wasn't coming like a Pharisee with that mentality. Jesus wasn't going to shun the sinners. He was going to embrace them. He was going to go in a completely different direction. His logic was impeccable. His assumption, his expectation was dead wrong. But what does Jesus do? Does he throw him a line? He tells him a story. This is the way Jesus works. He layers up all of these images. Think of how many times the kingdom of heaven is like, fill in the blank. He's trying to get something happening on the spiritual level. Some things cannot be approached directly. How do we approach a transformation? Like Nicodemus is talking to Jesus. When Jesus is talking to the Samaritan woman at the well, how do you approach something like directly? You know, Nicodemus misunderstands. What, am I supposed to crawl back into my mother's womb so I can be born again? And the Samaritan woman saying, oh, well, give me some of this living water so I don't have to carry this jar around anymore. They misunderstand because they're trying to process something directly. What Jesus is trying to do is trying to layer things up in their spirit until at some point they're going to break through. They're going to see that there's a there outside of that well. They'll be able to climb out on their own. This is the way Jesus works. So, the big question is how? All this stuff is really nice, but how do we do it? How do we become partners in God's work in us to layer up these images so that our expectations actually change? Well, I want to talk about, how much time we got? We got some time. I want to talk about three things that may help. You know, if it sounds like I'm throwing you a line, then forget about it, because just kind of let these images process over you. You know that voice in your head that's always talking to you? The one that's probably talking to you right now? That voice often is mistaken by us for who we really are. We think that voice is us. Well, that voice isn't us. That voice is the price of self-awareness. When we become self-aware, when we can think about our thoughts, when we can think about our own existence, you know, Descartes, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, the price of self-awareness is that voice in your head that talks to you, almost in a third-person sort of way. Now think about what that voice is typically saying to you. Loser. Not worthy. Why did you do this? Oh, gosh, how could you have been so stupid? What is the voice usually saying? Is the voice usually positive or is the voice usually negative? Typically, the voice is negative. The voice is the sum total of everything that we have become through our childhood, through the woundings and the hard knocks and the traumas and everything. That voice is the sum total of all that stuff in us at the subconscious level. And it talks to us out of that experience. It's not telling you the truth, but it's really loud. A pastor friend of mine had a perfect image for that voice in your head. And he said a friend of his told him it was called the monkey brain. It's the monkey brain. It's the brain that jumps around from limb to limb and tree to tree and is constantly chattering at you. Always, incessantly, all the time. How do you get the monkey brain to shut up? What was that? That might come at quite a cost, I don't know. Less radical than shooting it. Try giving it a banana. For as long as it takes for him to unpeel and eat that banana, he's occupied and he's not talking to you anymore. How do you give the monkey brain a banana? Well, we just did it this morning, hopefully. Do you know why music is so powerful and so important unto all peoples in their sacred lives and in their worship, is because music gives a bed on which to rest the monkey brain. And the monkey brain kind of floats around for a while, listening to the music and occupied by the music, while you can actually get some spiritual work done. Now, you can walk into a worship session, you can approach it one of two ways. You can sit there and say, "Good grief, they've already sang four songs. They sang that chorus about 15 times already. When in the world are they going to stop?" If you approach worship music the way you approach contemporary Christian music or any other type of music, you're going to be bored to tears. Worship music is not all that interesting. It's not supposed to be. It's repetitious. The words are short and simple. And it's designed to sort of be a carrier wave on which your consciousness, the monkey brain, floats away for a while and leaves you in peace, taking a vacation from the monkey brain. You know, the Catholic Rosary gets bad rap from a lot of us Protestant types and non-denominational types. But that's just another way to get the monkey brain a banana. You sit there with your prayer beads and your brain goes on hold. You're mindlessly going through a repetitive prayer over and over again, counting away on the beads. The monkey brain has his banana. He's happy. He sits over there, and now you can get some spiritual work done. Have you ever heard it said that an alcoholic, at the moment that they start drinking, if an alcoholic starts drinking at age 16, when they're 30, emotionally, they're still age 16, because they haven't done any of the psychological, emotional, spiritual work in all that period of time because they've been anesthetizing it with the alcohol or the drugs or whatever else you can get addicted to. You know, we can be addicted to our monkey brain in the same way. The more we identify with the monkey brain, the more that we're listening to the monkey brain, the more that we are letting atrophy our spiritual growth. It is those moments when the monkey brain has the banana that we are actually doing some spiritual work. Music is one way to do it. It's a beautiful way. Prayer is another way to do it. But not just thinking and talking prayer all the time, not just a stream of words, because that's keeping the monkey brain active. It's a type of prayer where you get silent before God. The Psalms tell us, "Be still and know that I am God." That's what we're talking about there. It's that kind of prayer. Sometimes it's called centering prayer. Sometimes it's called contemplative prayer. All it is a way of giving the monkey brain a banana so that you can get some work done. Think about any time in your life when the experience was so intense that you weren't thinking about anything else. You were looking into the eyes of your lover. You were holding your baby for the first time. You're watching a sunset. You were laughing at a great joke. What were you thinking about at that moment? Nothing. There was no room for anything else because you were immersed in the moment. These are times that we have a chance to let go and take a vacation from ourselves. We need to cultivate that. Physical exercise, running, biking, anything that is repetitive, you just get the body moving and let it go, and your consciousness, your spiritual consciousness, floats somewhere else. I think you've all experienced this. We need to cultivate this, and we need to turn off the monkey brain so that we can get a break from all of that. In those periods of time when we are not thinking about our thoughts, God is layering things up in our spirit that will take us further and further up and out of the well that we've happened to find ourselves in. The fact that you have thoughts in your head, you can't turn them off without being a sentient being, a human being. But here's the distinction. You don't have to think about the thoughts, do you? They're back there, but as soon as you think about them, think about this. You're having a conversation with somebody at a restaurant. There's traffic and noise out in the street, and there's clinking of dishes and all that. And you're aware of all those sounds around you, right? But you're face-to-face and eyeball-to-eyeball with the person you're talking to, and your conversation is uninterrupted. Now a waiter drops a tray of dishes. Bam! All eyes turn over there, and now your conversation is interrupted. You are thinking about the noise rather than let it just wash through you. That's the difference. So if you can get to the place where the voice is there, but you're not thinking about it, you're concentrated over here, that's a good time. That's a vacation from yourself. That's a place where you can feel spiritual progress taking place. That's another shovel full of dirt down on the top of your head, and you can step up a little bit higher. The second thing that I wanted to talk about is what I'm going to call macro despair. Just because we get so over-identified sometimes with what's happening out in the world, don't we? the environment, society, politics, economics, all those things out there, those big picture issues. And if you get or maybe send those emails telling, you know, boycott Exxon because they're raising gas prices, and boycott the Da Vinci Code because it's evil, and boycott Senate Bill 1437 because it has to do with this, that, and the other thing. You know, we all can get involved in those things. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't be good stewards and try to take care of what we can. But to get over-identified with that stuff is to continue to make your life miserable. What do we say in here almost every meeting? We say the serenity prayer, don't we? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. You know, those macro items out there, they're not going to change necessarily. And they're not going to change by our efforts alone, and they're certainly not going to change because we worry about them. And so over-identifying with those images and those issues is going to keep you in a miserable place. If you see yourself primarily as a Republican or a conservative, you know, or a libertarian or whatever it happens to be, and that is really what you're focused on, then that's going to be a misuse of your focus. We need to focus someplace else. The two biggest things are the environment and social political things, right? In other words, we're worried about what we're doing to the planet Earth, and we're worried about what we're doing to each other. But let me tell you something. As far as, global warming is the latest thing that we're supposed to be worried about in terms of the Earth falling apart. And to me, it seems like we're kind of arrogant to think that we can affect God's creation to this degree in a short period of time. I see the Earth more as kind of an etch-a-sketch. You know, God writes on it and builds this great picture, and then he just sort of shakes it up and starts over again. Nothing is lost. Everything is still there. The next asteroid that hits, it shakes up the Etch-a-Sketch, and we start over again. We had dinosaurs before, we got mastodons now. Okay, whatever. And if you're a young Earth creationist, I apologize for that comment. But what I'm saying is we can't take these things so seriously. And as far as the social political things, you know, the fact that the world is running at all, that you can go and get on a train or a plane and it actually arrives on time and takes you where you want to go, that the buildings are still standing and the electricity is on, what does that tell you? It tells you at least 75% of the people are decent, law-abiding people. Because if they weren't, nothing would run. It would be anarchy out there. Most people are just paying their taxes and trying to raise their kids and trying to do the best they can. The media is going to focus on the 10% of wackos on either end of the spectrum, and they're going to make it look like that's all that's out there. But we have to realize, no, it's not. We can relax about these things. And the most important thing, and you're starting to get a theme here, we can't over-identify with the monkey brain, and we can't over-identify with those groups that we belong to out there, no matter what they are. What is it that you put on your license plate on the back of your car? That's what you identify with. That's what you want the world to know you as. Sometimes it's a little scary when you see what people put on the back of their license plates, isn't it? If this is what they want to be defined by, don't over-identify with those things. And then the third thing, maybe let's call it micro-frustration. These are the things that are involving your life in particular, the things that are affecting you. And let's not trivialize them, because sometimes they're really, really traumatic and serious. The death of a loved one, the death of a child, the loss of a job, the loss of a dream, an illness, a disability, all these things can throw us. We didn't ask for them, we didn't plan for them, but here they are. Then there are the things that we imagine, the things that we worry about. But those are no less real, are they? Because they're part of those expectations that we form. How do we deal with those things? The things that are personal in our life. I think what I want to do is to try to show you again the way that Jesus approached things. He said that unless we become like little children, we can't enter the kingdom. I was on a hike a few weeks ago, and a group of us went, and I brought my 20-month-old son. And he was not hiking. Yeah, he didn't have a walking stick and boots. No, he was in a little a jogging stroller. And so it was one of these things you push, and it's got a little canopy that flips down, and there was a clear window pane right there, so I could look down and see the top of his head. And we're going along, and we're up in Riley Wilderness Park, and so we're going through all these trails and everything. And a lot of it was really overgrown, so the trail got really narrow. And this tall, 4 or 5 foot high mustard grass with the yellow flowers on top was all around. And so we're moving through, and we're having actually to push this grass out of the way as we go. And I'm looking down at Brendan's head, and he's just stock still and just fascinated watching this. And all of a sudden it struck me, what does that look like from his point of view? So I did one of these where I got down real low, and I'm trying to push the stroll like this, and I got my head even with his, and I'm looking around to see. And the entire world changed. The picture changed completely. Suddenly I was on this path that looked like some kind of hobbit trail in the Lord, you know? And the path goes out here, and there's all this huge growth that even kind of canopies over, so it's like this tunnel, and the path goes off this way. And there's no sense of scale. You can imagine a horse and rider coming around there, or a wagon or anything. The whole thing changed. Now, from 5 or 6 feet high, we can see the tract homes out in the distance, and we can see the little trail that we're following. From 3 feet high, everything is different. Life's an adventure again. It was wonderful. And this is what Brennan was seeing. Can we shift our viewpoint so that we can see life as an adventure again? You know, if your child, your little child, loses something, like Brennan lost our remote control for our television, how do you find something that your 2-year-old lost? Well, the surest way to do it is get down on your hands and knees so that you're looking at the room from their point of view, because you see all these little nooks and crannies that you don't see when you're standing up. Oh, that's where you put it. Of course, it didn't work for us. We still don't know where that remote is. But in theory, it should work. But the point is, we have to do this. If we can lower, I don't want to say lower expectations, because that sounds like compromise. It's not that at all. It's see life from a different point of view. If we've lost something in our lives, if we can take our viewpoint down, we can find it again. That thing, that first love that we had years ago that we lost somehow in all the stuff of life. See things again from that point of view. There's a story, another one about a little child. It comes from a movie, I can't remember which one. I think it was Working Girl, where they have a semi gets wedged under an overpass in New York. And it's stuck in there, and they can't get it out to save their lives. And traffic is backing up in all directions, and they get the engineers in and the civil this and that, and they can't figure out how to do it. And there's a little kid standing on the sidewalk, and he says, well, why don't you just let the air out of the tires? So they let the air out of the tires, the truck comes down, and they just roll it right out, no problem. Sometimes our view of ourselves is so inflated. Our expectations of what we're supposed to be achieving, what we haven't achieved, and so on and so forth, is causing so much of this stress and misery in our lives. If we can let the air out of our tires, we can fit right through and go where we want to go. But that's part of this whole becoming childlike thing. You know, that line we talked about, we're lost, but we're making good time. What about the plans that we've made? The plans that we made, the places that we think that we're going, if we can realize we're lost, but we're making good time, maybe we can start to have fun again. I think a quote I heard was, if we didn't spend so much time trying to be happy, we could probably have a pretty good time. It's like, hold lightly to the plans that you make. Work hard. Go for them. Follow your dreams. Follow your bliss. But realize, how many of these plans that you have made in life actually turned out exactly the way that you planned? You know, very few do. That's okay. We can still enjoy the ride as we move on through. And one other image I wanted to give you is the idea of the RCA dog. You know, the one who's looking at his master's voice in the Victrola horn there, and he's got his head cocked and he's looking, and he knows that this is his master's voice, but something is wrong here. It's coming from an unfamiliar, unexpected place. We need to start looking and learning to look for truth, looking for our master's voice from unexpected places. If we only look where we expect God to show up, if we only look where we expect truth to be, we're going to miss it when it comes by, aren't we? All of these things are part of this. Now, what did I just do for y'all? I threw a whole bunch of shovelfuls of dirt on your head, didn't I? Image after image. I mean, from the monkey brain, I hope that you carry that image with you all the time. That's a great image. From the monkey brain to the macro despair issue of over-identifying with this and that. From Brennan on the path and lowering your point of view, letting the air out of your tires, and the dog looking into the Victrola. All of these images, if you will let them, will start to layer up in your spirit. If you start when you hit certain circumstances in your life and you realize, oh, I recognize where I'm going now. I know how to get out of this one. And you can let the air out of your tires, or you can lower that point of view so you can see things from a child's viewpoint. All these things are ways that we can work to get through and beyond the limitations of our expectations and start to blow those expectations apart. Let God be God in whatever form and shape and place that He comes to us at. Jesus had a favorite phrase that He used. He who has ears, let him hear. He loved that phrase. He said it a lot. Do you know that that was a Jewish idiom? It was a way of speaking in first century Judea. And what it meant was, he who has understanding, let him understand. He who has understanding will understand this. Have you ever heard the saying, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear? How true is that? When the student is ready, he will be taught. The teacher is always there. The truth is always available to us. The difference is, are you ready to be able to apprehend it, to be able to accept it, to see it for what it is? At the end of Matthew 11, there's one of my favorite lines in the New Testament. And Jesus finally just says, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. I love that. But you know, that's not even the full translation. The word that is translated as easy there comes from the Aramaic word ba'asyam. And that word actually means hands. And it's hands as in hands raised over your head. Hands in rejoicing, merry, anointing. And that's what the word really means. It means to be merry, to be rejoicing, to be anointed. The Peshitta, which is the Aramaic version of the New Testament, translate that as pleasant. Jesus says, my yoke is pleasant and my burden is light. I love that. But my yoke is merry. My yoke is rejoicing. You know, my yoke is anointed. All these would be accurate translations of that word. There was an ancient Jewish name for God, which was Eloah. Eloah, which comes from El. And literally that word means the yoke that binds. And the word, where this comes from is that the ancient Jews were farmers, and when they had a young ox who didn't know how to work the plow, they would yoke him together with an older, mature ox that knew the ropes and knew where to go and could follow commands of the farmer. And the older ox would show the younger ox the ropes and would show him how to work the plow. The Jews saw God as the older ox who was willing to yoke himself with their nation of Israel to show them how to live their lives and how to go through the rows and the plow. That's a beautiful image, and Jesus is building on that image here. He is the older ox that is willing to yoke himself with us so that he can show us how to live. He'll give us those images. He'll give us those insights if we will stay in the plow with him. And you know what? It's not going to be a miserable journey. It's pleasant. It's rejoiceful. It's merry. It's wonderful. All of these things. So what we need to do is to learn to enjoy that process. To see that process is ongoing. That's how you'll know if you're ready, when you start getting shovelfuls of dirt on your head. All right, let's pray. Father, we just want to thank you for the way that you work with us, Lord. The fact that you have every one of us personally on your mind. Every one of us that you are personally willing to yoke yourself with us, to walk with us every step of the way. That means that you will be with us every step of the way. You will experience the things that we experience because we're bound together and yoked together. Thank you for that truth. Thank you for that image, Lord. Help us to make that real in our lives as we move through each moment of our lives. Help us to see you in each moment so that the depression that we inevitably will feel will be shallower and shallower and shorter and farther between, Lord. That's our goal, to just see you in every moment that we live. Thank you for our lives. Thank you for our sobriety, Father. And thank you for your love. In Jesus' name. Amen.